The Palestinian Foreign Ministry calls for an international investigation into Saturday's death of a young Palestinian man at the hands of Israeli forces. At least 29 people are killed after a military plane with 92 personnel on board crashes in the southern Philippines. And U.S. officials put a halt to search and rescue operations at the site of a collapsed Miami building. More than 120 people are still unaccounted for. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called for an international investigation into Saturday's killing of a young Palestinian man by Israeli forces. The ministry also urged the international community to take practical steps to stop what it called Israeli violations against Palestinians. Well, the ministry said Tel Aviv is fully responsible for the death of 21-year-old Mohammed Farid Hassan. It described his killing as a crime. Mohammed was shot dead by Israeli forces in a village near the West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian media say he was among those who were fending off an attack by Israeli settlers on the village. A Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the Israeli regime's recent attacks on Gaza were a desperate attempt to regain its face lost during Palestinians' retaliatory strikes. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said Tel Aviv was, in fact, seeking to stop efforts aimed at restoring Palestinian rights. He noted that the Israeli attacks were aimed at changing the equations in its favor, adding such attempts will also fail. He underlined that the resistance front would press ahead with its struggle to ensure the rights of Palestinians and to secure them a life of dignity in the face of Israeli atrocities. The spokesman underscored Tel Aviv's moves will not intimidate Palestinians into retreating and giving up their resistance. Political commentator Mick Napier says Israel's recent attacks on the Gaza Strip have promoted unity among Palestinians.
Neither Israel nor its backers in the West expected the fierceness of the Palestinian response, and they know that this has been a game changer. You know, national unity is never a given. It always has to be achieved, and sometimes it slips away. But during the recent Israeli attacks on Gaza, on 48, on the West Bank, on East Jerusalem, and so on, national unity took a huge step forward for the Palestinians. They acted as a single nation facing the Zionist project to divide them from each other and then to dispossess them of the entire land surface of Palestine. That's well understood now. And also in the West, I have to say, more people know what's going on because of Palestinian resistance than was the case in the past.
A military plane carrying troops has crashed in the southern Philippines, killing at least 29 people. Defense officials say the C-130 military transport aircraft with 92 people on board went down while trying to land on Jolo Island in Sulu Province. The aircraft flying from the southern city of Cagayan de Oro burst into flames when it missed the runway. 50 people have been rescued from the burning wreckage and hospitalized, and 17 others remain missing. Many of those on board were soldiers recently graduated from basic combat training. They were being deployed to the rest of the island as part of a joint task force fighting terrorism. Meanwhile, rescue operations are underway in Japan after heavy rains triggered a massive landslide in a village in Shizuoka Prefecture, killing two people. 1,000 rescuers, including military personnel, are involved in the rescue operation. It is focused on finding 20 people who went missing in the central city of Atami. Torrents of mud crashed through parts of the town on Saturday morning following days of heavy rain. Prime Minister Yoshida Suga said at an emergency cabinet meeting that up to 130 houses and other buildings have been damaged. Survivors have taken refuge in an evacuation center near the village. It comes after locals were put on alert as more rain lashed the area. floods are common during Japan's rainy season. U.S. officials have put a halt to search and rescue operations at the site of a collapsed Miami building ahead of a planned demolition and possible arrival of a tropical storm there.
Search and rescue does have to pause temporarily while the demolition preparation is underway, and that there is threat to the standing building that is posed to the first responders, as we've told you. So preparation includes activities like drilling into columns in the unsafe structure.
Have I noted that 121 people are still unaccounted for. The death toll officially remains at 24, however. The mayor said she signed an order calling for the immediate demolition of the building. That could happen anytime on Sunday. She added that the families of the victims have been informed about the decision. Almost half of the 12-story building abruptly collapsed early in the morning on June the 24th, when many residents were sleeping. The cause of the incident has not been determined yet. Initial attention has focused on structural deficiencies described in a 2018 engineer's report. Every year, Americans celebrate their National Independence Day on July the 4th, but this year, the event is not a cause for celebration for many Americans. That's because their country is experiencing a host of challenges, including the pandemic, police brutality, and racial discrimination, especially against African Americans.
Since 1941, Americans have annually celebrated Independence Day on the 4th of July, a celebration that goes back to the 18th century, when American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. The Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, endowed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it seems these laws did not apply to Native Americans as well as African Americans. This 4th of July, the United States is grappled with a global pandemic. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the coronavirus pandemic in terms of infections and fatalities. Also, the U.S. is experiencing an intense period of political and social unrest. On January 6th, a mob of then-President Donald Trump supporters stormed the Capitol while Congress was holding sessions to officially certify President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 race. The attack left five people dead, including a Capitol police officer. Trump's critics said his incendiary remarks during his speech on the same day encouraged his supporters to storm Congress. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. Experts say the dramatic gap in police shootings and prison rates reflects biased policing, as well as the vast economic and educational inequalities that plague much of the country.
Because the United States has never, ever really come to grips with the racist foundations of the country, and it has never come to grips with the racist elements within the country that continue to this day.
We'll continue with more news this hour. Russia says the recent violation of its borders by a British Navy destroyer is a kind of provocation that will receive a tough response. The Kremlin says the breach of its territorial integrity was deliberate and pre-planned. Russia has summoned the British ambassador in Moscow over the incident. Tensions between Moscow and London soared last month. That's when Russia accused HMS Defender of illegally entering its waters in the Black Sea off of the coast of the Crimea Peninsula. Russia said it had chased a British destroyer out of its waters with warning shots and bombs. An account London has rejected. Britain, however, has confirmed that its warship had sailed through what it described as Ukrainian waters. A shock win has been recorded for Britain's Labour Party in a by-election. Labour were pitted to lose their key seat as many Muslims in the area have become deeply angered at the party over perceived Islamophobia, anti-Palestine crackdowns, and a policy U-turn on the Kashmir issue. Robert Carter reports on the story to gauge the reaction following the result.
I do hereby declare that Kim Michelle Leadbeater is duly elected.
The UK Labour Party secured a narrow win in the key by-election constituency of Batley and Spen in northern England. The results announced early Friday morning shocked many as Labour was tipped to lose the seat to either the ruling Conservatives or Workers' Party GB candidate George Galloway.
The battle for Batley appears to have left a bitter taste after accusations of racism, harassment and even dirty tricks has circled the headlines over the past couple of weeks, with Batley's Muslim community also apparently playing a key role after turning their backs on the Labour Party over perceived policy injustices regarding Palestine and Kashmir.
Amid accusations of poster vandalism by Labour activists, Mr. Galloway vowed legal action.
We have been multiply defamed to the point that I'm no longer prepared to talk with the mainstream media, which is why I'm talking to you now by this live stream. The whole election campaign was dominated by lazy and false tropes about our campaign, about the thousands of people that voted for us, about their motives for doing so, in a way which defamed them as much as it defamed me.
Despite Labour's win, experts claim Muslims still sent a strong message by removing their traditional loyal support.
So Muslims, this is an opportunity to build alliances with the voiceless in our wider communities. And for those who are outside of the Muslim community, look at us as your allies. We want to flex our political muscles, and we are happy to do so alongside you, inshallah.
Despite Labour's win, British Muslims remain deeply frustrated. This aspect could affect future votes unless the party changes its policy towards Muslims dramatically. Robert Carter, London.
Well, Iran has announced 165 new daily deaths from COVID-19 as the spread of the highly contagious Delta variant has raised fears of another devastating surge. The latest figure brings to nearly 85,000 the number of total COVID deaths in Iran. The country has also registered over 13,700 new cases in the past 24 hours. On Sunday, the government said restrictions will be tightened to slow the spread of the highly transmissible Delta variant. A nighttime traffic ban between cities remains in place. All non-essential businesses will be closed in most cities, including in the capital, Tehran. Also, all public parks, restaurants, malls, and bookstores will be closed in areas with high infection rates. So far, over 3.2 million Iranians have got COVID. Three Iranian inventions have been verified and funded by the prestigious Global Innovation Exchange for the first time. As Saman Kajura reports, Iran's national invention team has also won several shining medals at Turkey's Global Innovation and Invention Competition.
This is the first time that three Iranian innovations have been approved and funded by the Global Innovation Exchange. Speaking at a press conference, head of Iran's national invention team said that the innovations have been evaluated by such international organizations as USAID, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations before they receive the funds. Global Innovation Exchange is a global development technology platform for innovations, funding, and insights. The three Iranian innovations include The Genetics of Success by Mohammad Aryan Akberi, which is one of the top ideas, which introduces a new formula to predict an individual's likelihood of success and could raise $187,500 fund from Turkey. And the next project is a smart hospital project by Amir Abbas Mohammadi Kushki, which has managed to attract $2 million fund.
بر اساس میزان ژن‌های استعداد.
Genetic success plan investigates every person's present situation, evaluates genes and heritability to predict to some extent that whether every person would be successful in his future based on his or her efforts. Implementing the genetic success plan saves the youth time and helps them choose their major in the future to get the best result.
I have invented a smart prevention robot capable of screening people for the novel coronavirus. The gadget scans the body temperature in 60 seconds through thermal camera. It also has been shortlisted among the top innovations for the MIT 2020 Innovation Challenge.
The third Iranian project approved by the Global Innovation Exchange has been proposed by Zahra Ghazavi, which is a cuffless blood pressure measuring device based on light sender and receiver sensors.
I've invented a cuffless device for measuring blood pressure, which can diagnose cardiovascular problems. It can also diagnose coronavirus using the blood hemodynamic.
Moreover, Iran's national invention team has won several shining medals at Turkey's Global Innovation and Invention Contest, Technofest 20 and ISIF 20, which were held by the World Intellectual Property Organization and the International Federation of Inventors Association, in association with Turkish Ministry of Economy and Turkish Intellectual Property Organization. In this round of competitions, Amir Abbas Mohammed Kushki won silver medal for its smart robot preventing coronavirus. Dr. Aryan Akberi backed bronze medal for his genetics of success formula, and Zahra Ghazavi won silver medal for her blood pressure measuring device. Moreover, for the first time, two Iranian innovations have made way into MIT University Global Challenge Solve MIT, which have been published on its website. This is the first time that a number of Iranian innovations have been well received at Global Innovation Exchange and have attracted international funds to develop the projects. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
And with that report brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Chunyun Mi, a respiratory disease specialist at Uha Women's University Medical Center in Seoul, South Korea, said the Delta variant of the coronavirus is a strain that is most optimized for widespread transmission. We now present you an article concerning this issue written jointly by Hyun Shin and Swati Pandey. The piece is titled, Highly Contagious Delta Variant Sweeps Asia, Prompting Curbs as Vaccination Remains Tepid. highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus is surging through Asia in recent days, with record numbers of infections in Australia and in South Korea, prompting some countries to tighten curbs and others to hasten vaccination efforts. The variant, first detected in India in December of last year, has spread to about 100 countries, and the World Health Organization, WHO, warned recently that it could soon become the dominant form of the coronavirus. It is also driving a spike in cases in Japan, casting a pall over this month's Olympic Games. On Friday, 2nd of July, Australia's New South Wales state, its most populous state, reported the biggest daily rise in new cases so far this year. Total cases in the state in the latest outbreak have topped 200, a majority caused by the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Sydney, home to a fifth of the country's 25 million population, is halfway through a two-week lockdown to contain the outbreak, which has alarmed authorities amid a sluggish nationwide vaccination drive. Professor Jill Carr, a virologist with the College of Medicine and Public Health at Flinders University, said, "I think the vaccine will certainly reduce the disease. It will certainly reduce hospitalization, but will certainly have the virus circulating in the community for those people who aren't vaccinated." Australia, like several other countries in Asia, has struggled to inoculate people as initial successes in containing the pandemic led to vaccine hesitancy, and manufacturers were slow to ship vaccine doses. Australia has fully vaccinated only 6% of its population, while Japan has vaccinated 12% of its population. Japan reported on Wednesday, 30th of June, that the Delta variant of the coronavirus now accounts for nearly a third of all cases in the eastern part of the country, including in Tokyo, and that could grow to 50% by mid-July. Japanese government sources told the Reuters news agency Tokyo and three neighboring prefectures are among areas under a quasi-state of emergency set to run through to 11th of July. And the recent uptick in infections has officials leaning towards keeping restrictions in place. On Friday, 2nd of July, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike reiterated that a ban on spectators for the Olympic Games, which start on 23rd of July, would be an option if the coronavirus situation worsened in Japan. In South Korea, officials said on Friday, daily coronavirus cases topped 800. The highest in nearly 6 months, with vaccination below 10% of the population. The average number of new infections in the country has risen for 10 days straight, and authorities in Seoul have delayed relaxing social distancing measures. Chun In-mi, a respiratory disease specialist at Yuha Women's University Medical Center in Seoul, South Korea, said, "The Delta variant is a strain that is most optimized for widespread transmissions." She said, "The cases of Indonesia, India, and Britain show that not just Korea, but many other countries will need to rethink their vaccine strategy and reopening plans." Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country, imposed emergency measures that begin on Saturday, 3rd of July, and remain until 20th of July, to contain a spike in the number of cases. In India, the number of new infections has eased to two-month lows since hitting a peak of 400,000 a day in May, with the government focusing on mass vaccinations. The United States has also seen a rise in Delta variant infections in parts of the country where vaccination rates remain low, and the White House said on Thursday, 1st of July, that it would send special assistance to those hotspots. Europe, too, is battling an increase in infections, which the World Health Organization has blamed on crowds at Euro 2020 football stadiums. It has warned that a new wave was inevitable if people did not remain disciplined. Germany said recently it expects the variant, the Delta variant, to account for up to 80% of infections this month, and Portugal imposed nighttime curfews. The fresh cases have put a damper on summer tourism in the European continent, although the launch of a European Union COVID-19 travel certificate may prompt more travel. Europe's drug regulator said on Thursday, 1st of July, that COVID-19 vaccines approved in the European Union offered protection against all coronavirus variants, including the Delta variant. In Asia, international tourism is largely suspended. The exception is Thailand's tourist island of Phuket, which reopened on Thursday, 1st of July, to fully vaccinated travelers from overseas in a step towards reviving a battered tourism industry in Thailand. Still, Thailand on Friday reported the third straight day of record coronavirus deaths. The Alpha variant of the virus, first detected in the United Kingdom, is still the dominant variant in the country, although authorities said they expect the Delta variant to dominate over the next few months. Kum Nuan Umchusak, advisor to the health ministry, said in Bangkok, it is nearly 40% within this month or next. It will all be the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Referring to the rising death toll, he said, if this keeps going, we cannot survive. World Health Organization WHO calls for better monitoring of Euro 2020 football matches as COVID cases rise again in Europe, fueled by the deadly Delta variant of the coronavirus that is racing around the globe. Hundreds of cases have been detected among spectators attending the Euro matches taking place across Europe, which carriers of the Delta strain detected in Copenhagen, Denmark, and infected Scots and Finns returning from London and St. Petersburg, Russia, respectively. Russia posted record virus deaths for a third day running on Thursday, 1st of July, while in Britain, where the Euro semi-final and final take place next week, infections are soaring despite a strong vaccination drive. The United Nations Agency's Europe Director, Hans Kluger, told a press conference, there will be a new wave in the World Health Organization European region unless we remain disciplined. Hans Kluger warned that the region had seen a 10% rise in cases over the past week, driven by increased mixing, travel, gatherings and easing of social distancing restrictions. Asked about whether the Euro Championship was potentially acting as a super spreader event, Hans Kluger replied, I hope not, but this can't be excluded. According to an Agence France-Presse tally, the coronavirus has killed more than 3.9 million people worldwide. On Thursday, 1st of July, the European Medicines Agency, the EMA, said two dozen of the vaccine appeared to provide protection against the Delta variant of the virus based on real-world evidence. But while some 3 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, the global vaccine drive has highlighted stark inequalities between countries, with low-income nations having only given an average of one vaccine shot per 100 people. Vaccine skepticism has also been an issue for many countries, including Russia, prompting the Russian President Vladimir Putin to urge people on national television to get the jab. On Thursday, 1st of July, Russia reported about 672 deaths over the past 24 hours, setting yet another pandemic record. Catherine Smallwood, senior emergency officer at World Health Organization Europe, told reporters, what we need to look at is around the stadia. How are people getting there? Are they traveling in large crowded convoys of buses? Are they taking individual measures when they are doing that? She added that it was also important to look at what was happening after the football games, for instance, if fans gathered in crowded bars. should this mixing happen, there will be more cases. The concerning situation in Europe coincides with the launch of an European Union-wide COVID certificate meant to ease travel for those living in the 27 member states. The document, essentially a QR code available on smartphones or on paper, shows whether the bearer is vaccinated with one of the EU's approved jabs, whether they have recovered from an infection or recently tested negative. But the surge in the Delta variant of the coronavirus could put an abrupt end to this, triggering an emergency break provision suspending the certificate's acceptance.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing in the next part of the program is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild root plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years, Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word Zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word Zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower Saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and a very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning, and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain, but there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, They can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Well, perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar and the kind and hardworking farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.